Today's episode is brought to you by Wise, the account that helps you manage your money around the world, which is huge for travelers. I've been a customer and a fan for 10 years. The Wise account helps you send, spend, and receive in different currencies fast, and they do it all without hidden fees or exchange rate markups. This service has been so critical for me in my life as a traveler, as a nomad, as somebody living abroad. And you can join 16 million customers and learn how the Wise account can help you out on the road at wise.com/travel. That's Wise, WISE.com/travel, or download the app. This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Travel to Europe this summer. What does that look like? It's going to look a little different than perhaps it normally would. And we've got some tips for you in today's interview with Paige McClanahan, who's an American travel journalist, actually living in the French Alps. So before we even get into some of the travel tips in Europe, we talk about how she ended up in the French Alps with her British husband and why we as humans are sometimes drawn to places we've never even visited. Has that happened to you before? For some reason, you have a pull to a place, like a magnet. Are you thinking about someplace right now? It's possible. We also share some tips on finding little ways to stay connected to your home country's culture when you're living abroad or overseas for an extended period of time. She shares her experience working with the UN and collaborating with an international team, which I think might become more common as remote work continues to explode. We talk about the gray areas of over-tourism and the selfish side of us being travelers. Hey, we want to see certain things. We're paying to go somewhere. So how do we be sensitive and be conscious, but at the same time, get the most out of our trip? She shares a great resource for finding unique protected areas in Europe. We talk about some of the side benefits of visiting natural areas. And overall, traveling to Europe this summer, is it worth it? That's on the agenda as well today. So much more. You're going to love the interview. Let's dive in to this show now. So buckle up, strap in, grab your favorite beverage. You know, I think about Europe, I'm thinking immediately about a little double espresso. I don't know, standing in some kind of small, charming cafe packed with locals and sipping on a double espresso. Anyway, grab your favorite beverage, strap in. Thanks for being here. And welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is a show to help you travel the world on your terms, to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. We're talking about my home continent today. Well, not my original home continent. I'm from the USA, but I've been living in Europe for quite some time, and it's been strange because I'm in Oslo, Norway, and during the summer, you see a lot of tourists around the city, and this summer, not so much. Not so much. It feels pretty barren downtown, but I feel like things are trickling in a little bit as people sort of peek their heads out and come out of the woodworks to start exploring the world again, which is exciting and I'm sure a little bit scary and also new in some ways. I feel like we're taking a fresh approach to travel. This has been some kind of crazy reset. I don't know exactly what it means yet, but for many of us, this pandemic has been a reset and can cause us to look at things a little bit differently, our lives, what we might want to do over the coming months or years, and maybe how we approach travel. I feel like it spills into everything in our lives. So I don't know if you're planning a trip to Europe this summer, but it's a popular place to go. So I recorded this episode for you to get it out so you could get some tips and some ideas. And of course, we ended up going in a lot of different directions in this interview. And one thing, I can talk about this at the end of the interview, Paige, our guest today, she did something that I'm a big fan of, that I've done myself, and I'm not sure if this is something that you've done or have considered doing, but I think this is a wonderful approach to the stationary traveler, the travel lover who is still going to have a home base somewhere. So I'll talk about that after the interview. So stick around for that. Now, please enjoy this conversation, and I will see you on the other side, my friend. I have the pleasure of talking today with Paige McClanahan. She is an American travel journalist and a regular contributor to the New York Times. She has lived in 5 countries since she left the United States in 2008 and has now settled down with her family in the French Alps. And you can check out her work over at PaigeMcClanahan.com. I will leave that link in the show notes. And what's really cool is when you go to that website, the first thing you see, it says, "I write about travel and tourism from my base in the French Alps." And I just thought, wow, that's cool. I can't wait to hear how she ended up there. So anyway, formally, Paige, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, well done with my last name. Few people get that on a first try. So, and yeah, thanks for mentioning the website. And I spent a long time trying to craft that sentence. So glad it spoke to you. But yeah, I feel pretty lucky to be where I am.
So I have to tell you, there's a bit of a story about the last name thing. I didn't even think twice because I went to Penn State University and there's a very famous store there called McClanahan's. It's almost like the original Walmart, but a mini, very mini version, right? It's got everything. It's got like the CVS like drugstore thing. It's got the knickknacks. It's got a place where you can get sandwiches. You know, this is before kind of like, and it's small and quaint and family owned, and it's called McClanahan's. And I used to work there, and I also used to get a lot of subs there. So
anyway. I'm gonna have to make a pilgrimage sometime. Usually, if people have heard of McClanahan before, it's from Rue McClanahan, who was Blanche in the Golden Girls, the actress who played Blanche. Yeah, perhaps a distant cousin, no known relation. But okay, McClanahan's in Western Pennsylvania, you said. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, Penn State University, State Penn College, State. Pennsylvania.
Okay, sorry, Penn State.
Hopefully
okay.
It's still there. I don't know. All right, so how did you end up all the places in the world in the French Alps?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's kind of a long story.
It's okay, we have time.
Okay. So, I grew up in the United States. I'm from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, originally born and raised, like one place. You know, I graduated from high school with the same kids I was in ballet class with when I was 3, you know, very sort of steady childhood. But when I was in graduate school, I did an internship in Geneva, Switzerland, and as a sort of summer between my 2 years of grad school. And I loved it, and I loved the job, and I loved being in Geneva. And then I met a guy, this cute British guy who worked on the floor below me, and who's now my husband and father of my 2 children. You know, an internship turned into a job, so I moved to Geneva, and we lived in Geneva for a while. And while we were living in Geneva, my husband and I both love the outdoors, we love hiking, and where we live now is about an hour from Geneva. And so we kind of got to know this valley just as a sort of hiking and skiing destination when we were living in Geneva, and we just fell in love with it. And then from Geneva, we ended up moving around to to several places. And along the way, we got married and had one child and had another child. And then when child number 2 was about 2 years old, we thought, maybe now we should sort of like settle in somewhere. And where in the world, if we could pick anywhere in the world to settle in, where would we, and raise our children, where would we want that to be? And we're like, that place, you know, that part of France, that was pretty cool. And my husband is British, and this was just right around, just after the Brexit vote had happened. So we knew the sort of clock was ticking on a British person being able to settle in a European country. So we were living in Kenya at the time. We were in Nairobi, and we thought, you know what? If we're ever going to do this move without a sort of a work permit to pull us in, now is the time. So we, Yeah, we were both working for the UN, actually, in Nairobi. And we quit our jobs and moved to a village of about, I think, officially like 800 people in France. And now we're both self-employed and our daughters are in the local school. And we've been here for about 3 years and are hoping to stay long enough to apply for French nationality. I feel like we were kind of in our earlier moves. We were down in West Africa and then we were in England and when we were in East Africa before coming here, it was almost like we were sort of dating around for our long-term host country. And here's where we ended up. So yeah, so now I'm self-employed and my husband's self-employed and we do a lot of hiking and a lot of skiing. So it's not bad.
Doesn't sound too bad at all. Can you share the name of the village or the area or the valley?
Yeah. So we're kind of between Geneva and Chamonix, sort of as the crow flies. It's our little village is called Sixt Fer à Cheval, which means Sixt, S-I-X-T. And then Fer à Cheval means horseshoe in French, because at the end of our road, there is a spectacular natural area, which is like a sort of a big kind of rock, natural rock sort of amphitheater with waterfalls coming off the sides. And that's known as like the Le Fer à Cheval, the horseshoe, because it's sort of in a horseshoe shape. So yeah, we're kind of one valley over from Chamonix. So Mont Blanc, you can't see Mont Blanc from our house, but the Mont Blanc picture on my website, actually that view of Mont Blanc is from, I didn't take that picture. That's a, you know, someone else took that picture, but you can get to that view within a pretty short drive of our house.
Sounds like paradise. Well, what do you like about the French culture? That must have been part of the decision, right? It's not just, there are a lot of places you can live and hike and have a mountain lifestyle. Why there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, I think part of it goes back to, I'm going to embarrass myself here, but when I was in high school, I mean, even starting from when I was like 11 or 12, I was a huge French dork. Like I was just kind of obsessed with France and all things French and the language. And when I was 16, I spent a summer in France. That was my first real kind of, yeah, definitely my first solo travel experience was I did like 6 weeks in France on an exchange when I was 16, and that really helped my language skills. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's something about the traditions and the history of France. Gosh, I'm going to just like spout some cliches now, but there's something about it that just feels like a good fit for me, and for our family. And yeah, so I don't know. So finding, you know, being able to use French, and I still love my French isn't perfect, but I love working on it all the time. So being able to live in a place where I have the mountains, which I've also always been drawn to, and I get to use this language that I really love, has been great. And yeah, other aspects of the culture, of course, we can talk about the food. I mean, our daughters are in, you know, a sort of a normal school here. They go to the cantine, sort of like the school cafeteria, most days of the week, and they have a four-course meal, you know, on china silverware. It always finishes with a sort of a local cheese, you know, and there are like emails going around, like the parents' email list about like the types of cheese that ought to be offered and not offered. And, you know, so it was interesting moving here from Kenya, because when we moved here, our younger daughter was 2 and our older daughter was 4.5. And in Kenya, people just love children. And they give children, like, you know, random, like, security guards will just, like, stop and coo at your baby. And children are given gifts constantly in shops. And if you're at the airport or in any sort of line anywhere and you have a child under the age of, say, 3, like, you are just brought to the front. Like, people say, oh, it's a child, you know, it's a baby, like, go to the front. France is a little bit different, to put it mildly. There's not a whole lot of indulgence sort of in children. So that was a bit of a, you know, not a shock, but a big change, a big adjustment coming from Kenya. But yeah, I got to say, like, our kids eat a lot more foods than I did when I was their age. And the I'll say they can have very good table manners, although they don't always.
I'm pretty sure that when I was that age, the only cheese I was eating came out of an individually wrapped plastic wrapper. Maybe it was Velveeta or one of those.
I didn't even like cheese unless it was like on a pizza until I think I was like 10 or something. And our kids talk about like, oh, can you tell, is this Comté? Is it like 12 mois or 18 mois affiné? Like, is it how old, how refined?
You're like,
how
I aged, don't know.
How aged is the cheese that you bought, Mama? You know? Anyway, so they're teaching me.
That's so cool. Yeah, I'm wondering, just going back to what you said about kind of the fascination with, I think the words you used, that you were a French dork.
Ask anyone who knew me, age like 16.
I was like, oh, that was that French dork. Yeah. I always had this draw to Colorado when I was living in the States before I'd even been there. I find it strange that certain people have this yearning for a place they've never visited. There are sights to see all over the world, you know? But I feel like it's more than just the sights there. There's some other deeper attraction to a place, even though you've never been before. Why is that? What is that all about?
I don't know. Do you know, that's an excellent question. But I'm not going to come up with a great answer to that question other than that I have the exact same question myself. I don't know if it's something that's sort of innate. I mean, I guess one thing that I will say with me and French in France is that my mom was a French major in college and so started and had always loved France. And like her first trip overseas was to Francophone Switzerland when I think she was 16. So she kind of instilled it in me a bit. But then my sister, who's 3 years older than me, was a complete sort of Spanish, you know, she loved Spanish and she loved the beach. I was always into mountains and French. So here I am. My sister was into Spanish and the beach. And now she lives in Honolulu. So no Spanish there, but the beach. But yeah, that's a really good question because I've seen that in other people. And I remember even when I was, I must have been 11 or 12. I think it was in like seventh grade, however old you are then. And we had this assignment in social studies where you could pick any country in the world and do a project on it. And I chose Switzerland, and I was like so fascinated with Switzerland and France, and especially the Francophone part of Switzerland, which is, of course, where I ended up meeting my husband and kind of starting this chapter of my life. So yeah, I don't know. There was some part of me kind of maybe knew in advance that these places would play a role in my future. If that sounds kind of woo-woo.
Yeah, I mean, totally. It's, if you just take those two moments, you know, happenstance or whatever, like if you picked another place to do a report on when you were 12, I don't know. Would that change things? I mean, who knows? But it's just fascinating. Who knows? This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off the beaten path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. And it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds. So you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there. And that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself. And that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. I love that you guys kind of just, you know, looked at, hey, what do we love? What have we seen? Where do we want to live? Okay, we're going to go to this place, which isn't always an easy choice, especially when you have kids. I have 2 kids. We're in Norway because, well, we didn't handpick Norway, but my wife's Norwegian. So, you know, a lot of it's family related and things like that. But you guys are in a place where neither of you has family, it sounds like. So is that difficult?
Do you know, I think it almost makes it easier in some ways. Like, well, I should say, so we lived in England. We lived in Oxford for 2 years, kind of between stints in Africa. So we were in West Africa, then in Sierra Leone, and then Oxford for 2 years, and then down to Nairobi. And that's actually where our first daughter was born. And we loved Oxford. And that was a really cool experience. Except, yeah, I think both of us, like my husband, you know, he grew up in suburban London. And, you know, he doesn't have he doesn't feel a huge pull back to his home country. I would say, like, I don't feel a huge pull back to the United States. And not that we don't love and value our countries and especially our friends and family there. But I think we both just really appreciate living somewhere that puts us out of our comfort zone a little bit. And the fact that we're here, it's sort of like neutral territory for us. It's like, it's not sort of my, you know, me imposing my culture on our children, or Ollie and my husband imposing his culture on our children. And we're kind of creating our own family's sort of Anglo-American French existence here. So it's almost like we get to create our own family culture instead of having to choose one that's sort of dominant, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. It's a unique way of looking at it because, yes, I mean, just being here in Norway, my kids, you know, they're half American, but they're Norwegian. They're doing all the Norwegian things. They're in the Norwegian culture. And my hope is that they can identify with some of the U.S. side of things at some point. I don't know if that's wrong. Like you're kind of bringing up a good point where it's like, hey, maybe we can just craft our own sort of culture. But also, it's hard to remove your childhood, right? Like that feeling of going and getting an ice cream and a good old American ice cream shop. You know, I want my kids to know what that feels like.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah. We can maybe swap some tips here on how we're doing that. I mean, I was always into sort of holidays and stuff growing up, but like, oh my God, when it dawned on me that like, if I don't do Thanksgiving, like my children will have no idea what Thanksgiving is because it's nowhere in the culture here. It's nowhere in my husband's culture. If I don't sort of like carry that torch, they will have no idea. So I make a big deal out of Halloween and Thanksgiving. And then, yeah, our older daughter really got into the Laura Ingalls Wilder audiobooks, like The Little House on the Prairie. So she listened to all of them, which I loved as a kid. So finding little ways to, you know, bring that in. And also, you know, I love going back to my parents' house in Chapel Hill. And actually, we're going back. I haven't been home now for 2 years. So it's the longest I've ever gone. Probably same for you. So we're going back next week and we'll be at my parents' house for about 3 weeks. And we're putting our kids into like a day camp, just a local day camp, you know, the kind of thing that I would have done as a kid so they can maybe make some friends and get a bit of that experience. So I think through summers and time, I'm hoping that by the time they get to be, and so I should say our kids are 5 and 7 now. But by the time they get to be, you know, at an age where they're deciding where they want to study or where they want to work or where they want to live, they'll at least be familiar enough with the culture in the United States and also in the United Kingdom, because they have American and British passports, that they'll sort of have a sense of what the places are like. And we talk a lot about, just as a family, about how, you know, Daddy and I chose to live in France and, you know, how it's important to find a place that you feel at home. And, you know, when you girls are older, you get to choose where you would like to live. So it's kind of like trying to start to have that conversation with them too. You know?
Yeah, that's cool. I had that thought of, putting them in a camp or something like that so they can have an experience that's independent of you, right? It's kind of like, hey, you're there, and throw them to the wolves and see... see what happens at the summer camp. No, I like it though. I think it's a great idea. And yeah, got me thinking. Anyway, I wanted to ask about your time with the UN. It sounds like you've been doing some pretty interesting work. It's also taken you around the world. What have you been doing? How was that experience? I just want to learn more about that.
Yeah. So I first started working for the UN. I should say when we were in Sierra Leone, West Africa, it was my well, then boyfriend, now husband's job that brought us down there. So he had a sort of a kind of a temporary contract with the UN, and I quit my job at a think tank in Geneva. I was working as an editor and got into journalism there. So that was, so we were, you know, our lives were sort of moved by the UN, but I wasn't directly involved. But that was a great place to be to break into freelance journalism, which maybe I can go into another time. But yeah, when we were in Kenya, I was working at the UN Environment Program. Actually, my husband was working for UN Environment Program as well. And I was in the communications division. So that was cool. I was there as a writer first and then kind of writer-editor. And I started off doing kind of a little bit of whatever needed doing. If they had a speech that needed writing or sometimes a press release, although I didn't do too much media stuff. Actually, they had a media team that did that stuff for the website. I was kind of helping out. And then I kind of grew into a role that was sort of managing the editorial content for the UN Environment Program, the website, but also reports and, you know, other publications that the organization is putting out. So that was a really interesting role because I was working with colleagues in web design and graphic design and video production and social media. And I was kind of in charge of the words, but also in charge of sort of, you know, kind of having all of those teams talking to each other. So that was, it was a really cool experience, primarily because I felt like I got to work with so many really talented colleagues and such. I mean, just working for the UN, it's, you know, our lead graphic designer at that point was Indian and our head, you know, of web guy was Italian and our social media guy was American. And, you know, you just, of course, I had loads of, you know, excellent Kenyan colleagues and an Irish woman I worked with. And so it's such a rich sort of environment to be working in. On the other hand, you know, sometimes when I think back to that time, we were, and you know, I know on your podcast, you've talked about sort of the difference between expat and immigrant and, you know, what it means to be an expat. And oh my gosh, working for the UN and living in Nairobi, that was about as much of the, you know, you can't get more sort of expat bubble than that. So I didn't really feel like I had a terribly Kenyan experience living in Nairobi. It was much more of an international experience. But yeah, I don't know, really interesting in its own way. Whereas here in France, you know, I guess I could call myself an expat, but I feel much more like an immigrant because I don't have that bubble around me, I guess. But yeah, no, working for the UN, it was really cool. I mean, it's, you know, it has it's an enormous bureaucracy, right? So it has all sorts of rules and things take a really long time. And, you know, I had worked as a journalist for a while at that point when I started working for the UN. And, you know, in journalism, usually you're doing things really quickly. And there's a very clear hierarchy in terms of who makes a decision. You know, it's like the editor makes the call, like you, the journalist, even if your name is on there, you don't get the last say, especially in something like the headline or, you know, so it's very clear who makes the final call and who makes the decision. Whereas in the UN, it's like everybody gets to have their say and, you know, somebody can, you know, I don't know, 10 people can agree, but one person disagrees. So you have to go back to the drawing board. So coming into that kind of culture after coming from journalism was a little bit like, oh my God. But, you know, it was good for me to, it was a good sort of shift as well, but.
Anyway. It's just a different way of doing business.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's absolutely
another thing to adopt to. Like, you have to adopt to many different things when you live in a foreign country or, you know, and if you're working internationally, it's a good reminder to keep, to not just assume that your way is the only way, right? I mean, I guess that's something that travel that reinforces constantly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, that makes me think of something. So, you know, especially, excuse me, with regard to parenting, I found it so interesting because, you know, I was pregnant and had our first child in England. And then we moved to Kenya where we had our second child. And now we're living in France, or, you know, we have both of our children. And of course I grew up in America and have friends who've had children, and my sister's had children in America. And so all the different advice about like pregnancy and little babies, it's like, it's so different. You know, should the baby sleep in the bed with you or not? How much clothing does a baby need? Oh, and should a pregnant woman drink alcohol or no? Like, it feels like when you're in a culture, it can feel like it's so black and white. And then you go to another place and they have the complete opposite interpretation of that. You know, they have a completely different perspective on that question. And it just makes you think like, okay, all of these things that we take as givens are just like, it's all just so subjective, you know? So you just find your own way through. That's been my approach.
Right. It really is. We should talk a little bit about travel in Europe. I think that's your focus, right? I mean, you essentially focus on that region, I would say. Are you specializing in Europe?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when we moved here from Kenya and I was like, okay, I quit the UN job. It's like, I want to get back into journalism. I'd done lots of travel features for the Washington Post, and I'd done a lot of stories for the Guardian and stuff before. And I'd done one story for the New York Times travel section before we like moved to Kenya, and I kind of got into UN work. And so I pitched the same editor I'd written for like 5 years before. And like, you know, lo and behold, she wrote back and said yes to my pitch. And I was like, whoa, okay, that's cool. So I developed a good relationship with this editor. And here I am, you know, in the French Alps. And like, there she is in New York, right? And working for the travel section. And, you know, Americans are really hungry for travel content about our continent, Jason. And so I found myself in a good position. And so what I try to do, I mean, I started off doing 36 hours columns for the New York Times. I don't know if you might have come across this. They call it, yeah, like the column, 36 hours. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. It's been, you know, put on hold, or it was put on hold for the pandemic, during the pandemic, and it's still, you know, they haven't sort of revived it to us. I don't know what the plans are. But I started off doing 36 hours columns for them, and then started pitching more sort of in-depth stories. Not necessarily, yeah, I mean, I guess not kind of your traditional travel features, and like not kind of travel essays, but more reported stories. Because in my journalism before, like when I was writing for The Guardian, a lot, that was, I was really doing news reporting. So I was trying to find a way to still write about travel, but do it in a slightly more thoughtful or like analytical or critical way than I had done in like the travel features I was writing for the Washington Post. So take the kind of lens, yeah, a journalistic lens to the travel and tourism industry. And yeah, and my, you know, the editors in New York were open to that and kind of let me give it a try. Yes. And then from there, I was just kind of pitching more stories, looking at how travel and tourism, you know, some of the challenges involved with it, but also the economic importance of the industry. You know, I'm just kind of fascinated by how travel and tourism affects the lives of the people who live in the places that are visited. I mean, I say this partially because we do live in I said our village is so small. Like, I think it's about 800 people. I'll have to check the official sort of stats again, but it's a very small village. But the nature area at the end of our road that I mentioned earlier gets 500,000 visitors a year. Right. And those are mainly French people actually coming to go hiking. Yeah. And there's one access road and it's at the end of our front yard. So at the height of the sort of French summer, you know, grandes vacances, like last summer, last August, there were days when like the road in front of our house, like goes right by our chicken coop, you know, was just like a parking lot. There were cars just bumper to bumper waiting to get into the parking lot at the end of a mile and a half up the road. So, you know, so I think tourism, but then our village wouldn't, like, you know, it would be, without tourism, it would be a ghost town. Without the ski resort, there's a ski resort about 10 or 15 minute drive from here. It would be a ghost town without tourism. So we really needed, there wouldn't be a supermarket in our area without tourism, so I think, finding that, exploring that sort of balance between, how tourism can support an area, and even support a culture, and how it can be damaging, I think it's just a really fascinating gray area. And that's kind of, I've chosen that gray area as basically like where I want to focus my journalism now. So I think there's a lot to dive into. Well, and just, you were asking about, am I focusing on Europe? And I think every story I've done for the New York Times has been about Europe, except for one about Antarctica, which they actually, my editors came to me and said, could you look into this for us? And that was, I didn't travel for that one. I just did that from here, doing lots of Zoom calls and stuff. But I think Europe, because it is, the economy, most of the economies in Europe depend a lot on tourism, perhaps more so than in the United States. So, and we see it now with Europe opening up to Americans, vaccinated and unvaccinated now. Whereas we see on the United States still fully closed, like not even a sort of quarantine option for non-Americans to get into the US. And it's like the US doesn't need those visitors as badly as Europe needs its visitors from across the Atlantic. So I don't know, interesting sort of power dynamics at play in the tourism industry as well.
Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected. And I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning. And you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled BABBEL.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, Jason here. Did you know we have a free weekly newsletter over at zerototravel.com/newsletter? I put my heart and soul into this newsletter and love keeping in touch with listeners off the podcast. That's where you can find out about all of the latest and greatest events, trips we're planning, and of course, you're going to get money-saving travel tips, destination advice, all kinds of stuff to provide value and help you add more travel into your life. So why not sign up? Again, totally free, no cost at all. zerototravel.com/newsletter. Excited to welcome you into that community. Thanks for listening.
That gray area you described is, I feel like, there is a whole heap of things to unpack within that area. Let's kind of go through that lens as we explore some destinations, because I'd love to hear from you. You know, we're talking to travel lovers here, active travelers, people that are planning traveling. A lot of people listening to this show, you know, maybe doing it longer than the typical sort of 2-week vacation. People that like to travel long term, have a real in-depth experience and all that good stuff. And as travelers, of course, we have the choice to go to other places and not contribute to some of maybe the over-tourism problems that people are trying to solve right now. But at the same time, a lot of those places are heavily trafficked for a reason, because there are so many incredible things to see. You know, Amsterdam's a good example, and I know you've written about it. It's just a beautiful city. There's so much rich history, culture, opportunities for growth and learning about the world, about yourself, just in that one city. So how do you just kind of poo-poo that as a traveler and say, well, you know, I know it's really crowded, so I'm not going to go there. I want to be responsible. So I just want you to speak to, you know, Europe opening up, what that looks like for people this summer specifically, and maybe within, through the lens of kind of what we've discussed, like, you know, we could talk about some of the main spots, but also maybe some other places people should consider. I know that's like a multi-tiered question. I'm not supposed to do that, but I think you get my drift.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, maybe we'll start by, we can start by just talking about maybe some of the logistics of travel to Europe from the other side of the Atlantic. And I apologize to anybody who's listening from, who isn't from the United States, and who wants to travel to Europe, because my reporting on this has been for the New York Times. So I've always come at it from the lens of if you're an American trying to get into the US, whereas if you're coming from Mexico or Japan or Australia, I'm afraid I don't have specific answers for you. As of sort of June 2021, it's a lot easier for Americans to get into Europe. And it started off with, okay, vaccinated Americans, fully vaccinated Americans can come in. You might still need to do a test. And now that the US is officially on the green list in the EU, now in most cases, Americans, even who are unvaccinated, can get in if they have a negative test, and vaccinated Americans don't need to do, don't even need to have a test. So, you know, okay, so I say that, but on the other hand, it's an immensely complicated subject. And the way the EU works is, you know, from Brussels, they can make a recommendation and they sort of, you know, try to coordinate policies. But actually, when it comes to controlling a country's borders, like, those decisions are made by each country. So, which is why we have, there are a lot of different regulations. So it's always worth checking directly with the country that you're hoping to visit. And also, and just to say that the websites, in general, the websites of the US embassies are really, really helpful and really up to date, and really good sources of information. So if I were, you know, sitting in Chicago and I wanted to go to, I don't know, Czech Republic or something, I would just go on the website of the US embassy in Czech Republic, and then you'll get your, you'll get some really good information there. But yeah, so coming back, and you talked about sort of some of the over-tourism questions and stuff. And I think that's a really interesting term, you know, because I wrote a story about Iceland actually last fall sometime, I think it was in October. And this place, you know, that became sort of like almost the poster child of over-tourism in maybe, gosh, I'm forgetting the years now, but like 5 or 6 years ago, maybe. I didn't go to Iceland for the story. I was just doing it over the phone, but I interviewed a bunch of people in Iceland, and they all hated the term over tourism. I mean, obviously they wouldn't sort of embrace it being where they are, but they're like, you know, it's such a specific, like, it's just too broad to be helpful. It's not like, you know, when you talk about over tourism, what you really mean is like, you know, you need to look at a specific site, a specific sort of moment in time, and look at what the specific issues are, because, you know, a place like Barcelona or Amsterdam or Venice that might be famous for over tourism. Well, if you visit Amsterdam in January, February, like, that's not going to, you know, you're going to have a very different experience than if you go like the second week of August. You know, when you're thinking of planning your next European trip or spending more time in Europe, you don't sort of necessarily have a knee jerk like, okay, oh, Amsterdam has an over tourism problem, ergo I can never go see the Anne Frank House or something. But just to think a little bit more critically about, or just to be being aware of the issues that are at play there, and thinking more critically about how you can do your best to sort of minimize contributing to any sort of overcrowding problems while you're there. But in terms of, I think, you know, maybe your listeners are more sort of aware of this than kind of typical travelers. But I would really encourage people coming to Europe to explore some of the natural areas on the continent. I mean, I think I know certainly growing up in the US, when I thought of Europe, I thought of Rome and Paris and Florence and Amsterdam, and But there are so many like fantastic and really beautiful national parks that people can explore, natural areas. You know, I'm thinking of, well, of course, the Alps where I am now. But if you want to see Mont Blanc, you know, you can also see it from the Italian side, and Courmayeur is beautiful. Elsewhere in France, we have like the Camargue area. down in the south with flamingos and sort of salt marshes, and the Calonque National Park, which is sort of like a Mediterranean fjord kind of vibe. I don't know. I would encourage people to look for atypical sort of European, quote unquote, sort of European experiences to enjoy. And, you know, and that might be a good fit for people, especially this summer, who, you know, maybe you're still looking for more fresh air or to avoid cities. So I think it's a really good opportunity for people to explore more natural areas. And I can go through other examples of places if you think that might be interesting.
First of all, you had me at Mediterranean Fjord. I mean, that sounds epic. All right, just a couple things going back to what you said before about travelers maybe being conscious of some of these things and over tourism. And I like what you said, that that term is too broad to be helpful. I mean, just that phrase, too broad to be helpful, can apply to a lot of things in life and business, I feel. So I just wanted to pull that out. But, you know, as travelers also, we are selfish, right? We want to see the things we want to see. We're paying money to go somewhere. We're putting carbon into the air. You know, there's that. So it's like, hey, we kind of want to make it worth it. Of course, it's got to be mutually beneficial. And I think what you said about maybe visiting in January or February or something like that, because that makes less of an impact on the city. But on the travel side, there are less people, less tourists. That means it's you know, probably cheaper to be there. It's you're going to be able to see things without all the crowds. You know, there are a lot of advantages on the traveler side as well for taking that approach. And it's kind of helping both sides of the coin, I'd say. So that's cool. And the natural parks and natural areas, I love this suggestion, particularly for this summer. And I was just wondering, because I know you probably have a few more destinations you can share them, but do you have some resources where people could go and maybe learn about some of these natural areas and kind of do their own research? I mean, you're a journalist. I know you do a lot of research, so I figured I'd ask.
Yeah, that's a great... I mean, well, the first thing that comes to mind is I actually wrote a story about this for the New York Times back in December. That was kind of more looking at the challenges facing these places. But to be honest, like, in general, a lot of national parks had more crowds than usual last summer, as just sort of Europeans were discovering their local national parks. You know, everybody wanted to get out hiking and stuff as soon as they were able to. So you can go, I interviewed a bunch of different sort of park managers, you know, from Germany to France to England to gosh, I forget where else. But that has a cool list of places. And I think, you know, if you can avoid, especially, you know, if you can avoid the sort of 4 weeks of August, or, you know, the four sort of main, maybe the last week of July, first 3 weeks of August, then you can really avoid a lot of the crowds. But I mean, they're in Norway. You should tell us about places to go. I've never been to Norway, and I'm sure there's some stunning parks and places. And then, like, while you answer that, I'll try to think of other resources that people can check.
No, that's okay. I mean, that's a whole other episode in and of itself, right? So, but we can kind of roll with this idea, I think, just as a general travel planning tip for Europe this summer, specifically, like you said, getting outdoors in some of these areas. And I always find these nature areas, well, they're so diverse. And also, it's not just the natural area itself, but oftentimes it takes you to towns and villages and places that you might not have otherwise wouldn't have gone through or to. And that's a big side benefit, I think, of going a little bit off the beaten track to a park that you heard was beautiful, but maybe it's not, you know, some main thing. But you take that little extra effort, and on the way, you know, you find the local restaurant or stand in some random town, and you have all these incredible travel experiences in between to and from. So I think that's another advantage of visiting natural areas.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for Americans who might be used to, or anybody who might be familiar with the national park system in the United States, they might be, you know, a little bit surprised to see that, but maybe pleasantly surprised to see that a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times in Europe, the parks are slightly more lived in. They're slightly more kind of part of the cultural landscape. I'm thinking especially of England. Like there's the New Forest, which is a beautiful area in southern England. And it's really, it's a forest, but it's also kind of old farming landscapes and villages and, you know, like 600-year-old pubs kind of tucked away in corners. So it's less about kind of pristine wilderness than maybe you would get in like Glacier National Park in the United States, and more about kind of preserving the entire landscape, which includes the sort of the cultural landscape as well as the natural landscape. And there are exceptions like the Swiss National Park, which is, there's only one in Switzerland, so it's the Swiss National Park, is a really pristine and wild place. Pretty sure you're not even allowed to go camping there, but hiking there is beautiful. And in terms of, I remembered the resource that I used in writing that story. So the if you go to the IUCN, so the World Conservation Union, they have a fantastic list of protected areas. I think it's called the Green List. And that's where I found a lot of the places that I ended up sort of mentioning in the story. So checking out the, and I interviewed a guy from IUCN whose name escapes me at the moment, but it's in the story. And so their Green List is a fantastic resource for finding natural areas.
I never heard of that. I see it now. I'm on it now. IUCNgreenlist.org for mm-hmm. that specifically. And we can put that in the show notes. So that's a cool, you know, you can always get some good research hacks from journalists.
I do my best.
You know how to dig around and find the good stuff.
Oh, God, right? Yeah.
Part of the job.
Google skills, man. It's it is key.
Ninja Google skills. Well, I feel like we've covered a lot, but at the same time, I also feel like we have more to chat about. So we have to have you back on some point if that's cool with you. I'd like to chat.
Absolutely.
I know we're at the end of our time here. I had one last question. I have a feeling I know what the answer is going to be, but I have to ask it anyway. Traveling to Europe in the summer of 2021, is it worth it?
Ooh, is it worth it? I mean, you know, if you've been dying to get to Europe and, you know, for like either to see people or to have a cultural experience or to just like get out of your house or get out of your hometown that you've been stuck in for however long, absolutely, absolutely, it's worth it. And, you know, I think people here are excited to have visitors again. I did a story about Disneyland Paris, which was kind of fascinating in its own way, for the New York Times that ran recently. And I interviewed the tourism minister of France for that one, which was cool. And he was just so And he was so enthusiastic. He was like, please, you know, we are excited to welcome Americans back. Please come back. And then I did a story about Greece, and they're really where, you know, one quarter of the country's workforce is in travel and tourism, and a fifth of the country's economy is travel and tourism. They're really hurting, and they would love to have visitors back. So I think, you know, absolutely, like, plan your trip, come on over, make sure you check the rules for your country, learn a little bit about what the country you're visiting, like what its experience of the pandemic was like, just so you can, you know, be a little bit attuned to that as you're going around. Make sure, you know, if there's some places still have curfews in place or nightclubs might still be closed, so, or masks might still be required. So just be sensitive to that. But otherwise, come and enjoy. Welcome back.
Love that. Well, thank you so much, Paige. And we'll link to all of the resources that you mentioned here in the show notes. Appreciate your time, and great getting to know you, and hope we can chat again soon.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. And take care.
Take care. There you have it. My conversation with Paige. I want to thank her for stopping by and sharing her expertise. And you heard us wrap up at the end there, you know, travel to Europe this summer. Is it worth it? I think you could sub in any destination, right? Is it worth it to travel this summer? Well, that's up to you to decide. But regardless of whether you go somewhere or not, I think there is this renewed sense of hope in some places, in some ways, and optimism and just appreciation for things that we used to take for granted that seemed quote unquote normal, just going out to dinner with a friend or sitting with a group of people and having a beer. If you're able to do those things and you're fortunate like I am to be in a place where, you know, people are getting vaccinated and you're starting to have the ability to be social again, it is so nice. The other weekend, I went out back and sat with a couple of my neighbors, and we just played guitar and hung out and talked and laughed. And it was so cool because it was just a normal thing, right? Normal, quote unquote. But we just haven't done anything like that for so long. Haven't been able to do anything like that for so long. And in that way, I feel that little travel buzz, kind of like, you know, getting with a group of people that you vibe with that are new, getting to learn about them, getting to ask them questions, getting to share a bit about your culture. I guess for me, living in another country, it's a little bit different because everybody around me, not everybody, but I'm often in contact with other people that aren't from my home country. So I get to take in a lot of different cultural perspectives. And that's one of the super cool things about living abroad. Speaking of that, I mentioned at the top of the show something that Paige did that I really love and something I've done as well. And I was wondering if it's something you've done or you've considered doing as somebody who loves to travel, but if you're somebody that also wants to have a home base somewhere, I really like what Paige did, which is just picked a place that she loved to live. And I know for some people that might be a bit gutsy, maybe not so much now if you're able to work remotely, but that's what I did when I moved to Colorado. When I was done traveling and I had been all over the United States many times and countries all over the world, I just picked a place that I loved. I didn't have a job there. I didn't have family there. It was just this place that I vibed with, right? Now, that was in my home country, was Boulder, Colorado, but still, you have to build a life somewhere, anywhere you go. Might be a little harder overseas in different ways because you have cultural differences and maybe visas and things like that, which is actually getting easier. But overall, the general concept is to just pick a place you love that has a lifestyle that you enjoy around you and just move there, right? And if you're a traveler, you kind of know the places you love. You know you like to have certain experiences. I think one of the things about travelers is we like to get out there and do things, right? So my move to Boulder was just to surround myself with other people that enjoy the outdoors themselves, the mountains, skiing, hiking, adventure, road trips, the American West, all the stuff that I loved. I wanted to be in that and near that. And maybe it was easier at the time. I didn't have kids or anything like that. But the same principle of just saying, hey, you know what? I'm not going to compromise the things that I love. I'm going to just pick a place that I want to be. Maybe I'm not traveling right now, but I can still be around the things I love where I live. That's not always easy to do. Family obligations and things like that. I mean, good example of me right now, I'm in Norway. I don't know if this is the place I would pick, but at the same time, I have been able to pick the place within Norway that I really like. Now we live next to the woods, next to a lake. We're still near the city. So, you know, you can even adapt that to the country or the place you're in. If you're like, hey, I have to be in this place, well, then find the best of that area, the best sort of blend of things that you want to have, and try to find a way to be there. I just think it makes a huge difference in your daily life. And certainly it has for us. And we talked about this on the show before we moved. We did a lot of pros and cons lists, and we figured out exactly kind of what we wanted and where we wanted to be that could give us the best things that we wanted to have in our lives, in our daily lives. So anyway, I just want to chat about that a little bit because I thought that was cool how Paige and her husband were just like, you know what? we're just going to go to this place in the French Alps because it's awesome. It's like, okay, that's cool. And I want to just pull that out because, hey, for some people listening, I know this was inspiring for me. Maybe it's inspiring for you. Maybe it's something you've done. Maybe it's something you want to do in the future, near future or far future. Either way, pretty cool stuff. So let me say thanks also to everybody on my email list who wrote me back. I sent out an email the other day asking, why are you on my email list? I really wanted to know. And I asked people to respond. And boy, did I get a lot of responses, which was awesome. So people just shared why. And, you know, usually sending out a couple newsletters every month with some curated content around travel, some thoughts, some links to recent episodes, and sometimes linking to other obscure things that I find interesting and whatever. If you want to hop on, by the way, you can just go to zerototravel.com and hop on the email list. You can find out about all the good stuff. You know, anytime we do workshops or challenges or different things like that, I always send a note to the email list. So if you want to hear about stuff going on off the podcast, you can join up over there. If you've been putting it off, just hit pause now, go to zerototravel.com and sign up. Unless you're driving, of course, then don't do that. Okay, let me leave you with a quote now. I'm going to reach into the old quote drawer, pull out something from my Wisdom of the East calendar. Love that calendar. Okay, let's see. This one is from the Buddha, who said, "Thought which is well guarded is the bearer of happiness." There you go. Enjoy the day. And we'll chat soon. Thanks again for your time. Thanks for being here. Peace and love, my friend.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.